There Is One by Gutmann Locks. Part 1 of 6. This book is dedicated to Jews in two stages of life. The unlearned Jew who has yet to remember, may your soul be soon set on fire, may you awaken to your inheritance and enjoy the ever-increasing joys of a Torah life. As it says, all her ways are pleasant and all her paths are peace. And to the scholar who has found the way around his palace, but has somehow forgotten his garden, may these writings in some way help to lighten the burden, and may we all live to see the final redemption for which all souls hope. May his holy temple be speedily rebuilt, and may all life know peace. Gutmann Locks, Old City, Yerushalayim. There Is One, Introduction. I had been away for a long time, some 40 years. It was hard, and if I didn't know better, I'd say it was mostly wasted. The road, sometimes black asphalt, sometimes plain dirt, always seemed to be going somewhere, but it didn't. Circles draped in different costumes, doors that opened into walls. Drive is a funny thing. If you want the goal bad enough, you keep going, even when reason says you are hurting. The more you want it, the more you're willing to give up. I wanted it. By the time I finally dropped my bag in my own house, I was a mess. I needed rest, and not just a breather in between trips. I wanted the peace that comes from finishing. I'd been camping on the beaches in the Pacific when my last trip had dropped me off. Life had run into another one of those familiar dead ends, and it was time to choose a direction. I chose Yerushalayim. I sat at the kotel and prayed, "All right, Lord, send me only a holy person because I'm going to say yes to whatever he says." Immediately a young man came up and asked, "Do you want to put on tefillin?" I had no idea what he was talking about. "Yes." "Look, I see you have money. You should buy a pair of tefillin." "Yes." "Come, I'll help you buy them." "Yes." "A very famous Rebbe just passed away. On the way to get the tefillin, we should visit his gravesite." "Yes." "Listen, you are buying tefillin, you should also get a tallis." "Yes." "You should get tzitzits." "Yes." "You should get a haircut." "Yes." "You should go to yeshiva." "Yes." Within 45 minutes, I went from looking like a long-haired street bum to a brand new yeshiva student trying to learn how to daven. It wasn't easy coming home, but it was better than where I'd been. But two things kept bothering me. One, no one wanted to talk about God, just about his commandments. And two, none of my friends were there. When I said, "God is all there is," they said, "You are talking like an idol worshiper." "No, it's true," I'd insist. "There is nothing besides God. You, me, this whole place, it's all God." I didn't last long at the first school I tried, nor the second. But then I found an angel who said, "Of course you're right, but you have to say it so a Jew can hear." Since then, I have found this point, God's omnipresent, to be completely hidden from the majority of even learned Jews. Although many learn day and night for 40 years, they still cannot understand that He is all. This is half of the reason for this book. The remaining half is that as far away from the truth are those who claim that God is not in a bathroom, even 100 times further away are the Jews who are throwing away their birthright by assimilating and intermarrying. The very survival of our people is dependent upon the attitudes of this generation. What fool would walk down the street with a hole in his pocket, listening to all of his change fall to the ground, and not turn to pick it up? Are our traditions of 4,000 years not worth more than the change in your pocket? Herein I have tried to explain in a clear and entertaining manner various jewels of Jewish thought and experience. Except for the obviously allegorical stories, all are true, and many are my personal experience. I trust it will motivate you to seek out your roots. Song of Return. My ship had gone down under me. I was left clinging to rubble, bobbing in a raging sea. It was dark and there was no hope. Even the morning light brought no relief. There was no water to drink nor food to eat. I held on as long as I could, expecting at any moment to become a stringy morsel for some giant angry fish. The salt water stung my eyes and my tongue began to swell. I screamed inside, but only echoes yelled back. Then a hard bump, and I lay flat upon a beach. I awakened and found next to me an ancient chest. I sat up and opened the lid. I was surprised how easily it opened. I had imagined something so old would have been rusted shut. I pushed, and it gave. Inside was every precious gift the mind could imagine. I went first for the cool, clear water. I drank, and my parched lips and swollen tongue were soothed. God, I thought, what could be more wonderful than a bottle of clear water? Once my thirst was satisfied, I could look at the other treasures. There was food that satisfied my bones and spices that revived my soul. There were aloes and oils that healed my wounds, and there were glorious garments and crowns fit only for a king. I tried them on, they fit well. A peaceful feeling came over me as I dressed as a king, adorned with the many jewels I had found. Jewels so rare, I did not even know their names. They shone beautifully in the light, and the more I handled them, the more their glitter increased. I went through the chest slowly, examining each treasure. I did not understand what many were, but all intrigued me. As I would study a particular piece, I found myself taking on the characteristics of that particular item. Light rushed into my soul, and I felt as if I had lost much weight. Strength filled my body, my mind cleared. It felt good to be alive. I began to sing, "How wonderful is this day!" Number one, there is one and no second. The most obvious sometimes seem to be the most elusive. The simplest concept can appear unfathomable, and the mind can seem to be but a useless tool. Do not give in to such thinking. The mind can quickly cut through its quandary, and clear thinking can emerge as easily as the sun can burn away a fog. One cannot be commanded to do something that is impossible, so the proof of one's ability to know God lies in the command, "Know this day and take it to your heart, that the Lord is God. In the heaven above and upon the earth below, there is nothing else." Deuteronomy 4:39. Number two. Consider, when the water lies still and the sunlight rests upon it, a single globe will reflect from the water. But when the wind stirs the water, making waves, the sun's light will bounce off the water, forming 1,000 reflections. Each reflection seems to be saying, "I am an individual reflection. I am over here in my location, and I am my own shape. While you, over there, are another reflection, not in the same place as I am, and not the same size as I am." And so it is with each of the myriad of reflections, each attesting to its individuality and its separateness. When these reflections are viewed upon the water, there appears to the mind to be 1,000 lights. But when the eye is lifted up from the agitated water onto the smooth sky, it is seen that there is but one. A single sun is laying its glorious light upon an agitated body of water. Even after the light touches the water, it still remains a single light. It is only because the water is agitated that the reflection seems to break up and form into many lights. But in actuality, there's always just a single light. And so it is with us. Although we appear, with good reason, to be many, in fact, we are one. Number three. Consider. The little finger says to the thumb, "I am a little finger and not so strong. You are thicker and sturdier than I." Alas, we come from the same place, and we are indeed related, but I am a little finger over here on this side of the hand, and you, a distant cousin, are over there. I have my life to live, and you have yours. I feel my pain, and you feel your pain. We are two separate lives. The fact is, the little finger and sturdy thumb are both really me. It is my hand. It is my life that fills these fingers, and no matter how distinct they are not separate lives. Distinction appears for a holy purpose, but does not constitute an actual severing from the whole. It is still one creation, one being. Even after the sunlight bends and many reflections begin to appear, the light is still one. So it is with all creation. No matter how distinct an object appears, the distinction does not entail an actual separation. The creation is a simple, constant one. Number 4. Consider. The table is an actual table, and the chair is an actual chair. However, when viewed with a microscope, the distinction of table and chair falls away, and small dots or squiggles can be seen. Also, these will disappear as we look deeper and come to atoms. The atoms will also give way to the subatomic, and the subatomic will give way to this, and this will give way to that, until at last we will come to the place itself, which is indisputably one. Number 5. Consider. A large room. This side of the room seems to be one place, and way over there by the far wall there seems to be another place. Each area or section pointed to can be defined by the mind as separate. But when the entire room is viewed, looking down from the ceiling, it is seen to be as it is, a single room. There is only one place. Definitions of the mind label objects. This serves an essential function. However, distinction must not imply a severing or actual separation from the whole. Number 6. Consider. A rainbow with its ray of colors is merely one light bent against the moisture droplets in the air, refracting and allowing its eternal glory to be revealed. Without the bending, the light would appear as a single, clear, colorless light. It is only after the light refracts that the distinction of color appears. Without refracting, there would be no recognizable distinction in the physical world. Table and chair, this or that, would all appear merely as one indivisible light, as if there were no depth to creation, just light manifesting as indistinguishable light. Distinction is essential for life to exist in form. Without distinction, there could be no progression, no point to or from, no apparent movement at all. The distinction enables life to see itself as an individual being requiring food or love. Distinction allows the struggle, the climb, the feeling of a peace, and of knowing. Distinction reveals the night and day, the seasons, youth, beauty, strength, and death. Distinction is the mind's tool to overcome, to accomplish its purpose and journey. Distinction is not an illusion. To deny it is to walk into walls. Number 7. Consider. A pair of eyeglasses equipped with microscopic vision as well as normal vision. View the table first microscopically, then press the button to view normally. Back and forth, molecules, table. At no time does the table change into a pile of molecules and then quickly revert back into a structure called a table. The table is still there even when only molecules are being viewed, and the molecules do not evaporate just because the perspective is switched to table vision. Both table and molecules exist at once. To understand that all is one does not contradict a molecule perspective as well as a table perspective. These forms are not illusion to be escaped from, but a tool to be used for achieving the goal of creation. Not an illusion, but a revelation to be elevated, as it is stated by the prophet Isaiah, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory." Isaiah 6:3. 8. Consider. A ladder has many rungs. Each rung could be considered to be a level. Likewise, When the tabletop is viewed, it also appears to be a level, a plane. However, since all of creation is continuous, the concept of level may be misleading by suggesting a separation within creation. When a broader perspective is considered, when creation is seen to be solid or continuous, the idea of level changes. From the center of a sphere, such as the Earth, to its surface is a continuum. There are no holes or blanks, no empty pockets of non-existence. The sphere continues from its center point to its surface constantly without interruption. At any point along the way, one may stop and say, this point is a level. Ad infinitum. The level is created by stopping and defining that point as a level. Without the mind doing this, the entire sphere would be created simply as one solid continuum. So it is with all creation. Levels are merely distinctions of the mind defining a portion of the whole. The mind recognizes distinction, and since the mind is limited from viewing the whole all at once, it defines only the portion it is capable of seeing. Number 9. Consider. A portion is the whole. Imagine a large wall. Now place your fingertips together, encircling a small portion of it. The area within your fingers is a portion of the wall. Now focus on the portion within your fingers as you slowly withdraw your hands. The portion is unaffected whether your fingers encircle it or not. The encompassing of an area does not remove that area from the whole. When you grab a portion, you grab the all. When someone taps your back or your toe, they're tapping you. Yes, one can limit the area and say it is only my back they tapped, or one can say, hey, that's me you're tapping. Both perspectives are accurate. But whatever the intention may be, the portion is not separated or severed from the whole by merely defining its limits. The whole includes every aspect. The wall is an entire wall, no matter how many times we encircle it into small portions. The all must include all. Number 10. Consider. One life fills all. The one life fills the 10 fingers equally. The one life enlivens the entire body. The fingers appear to themselves to be separate beings, but this is not true. Separate fingers, yes. Separate beings, no. The individual's body has one life. The physical body of humankind, that is, the body of man, is one body. The physical universe with all of its awesome distinctions is one universe, one body. This is seen in God's statement through the prophet Jeremiah. Am I a God near at hand, says the Lord, and not a God far off? Do I not fill the heaven and earth? And again, for the Lord thy God walks in the midst of your camp. Number 11. Consider, Hannah's song of thanksgiving is, there is none holy as the Lord, for there is none besides you. When King David exclaims, if I lie in the grave, you are also there, the simplest truth of existence is being proclaimed. God, you are all. Number 12. Consider, ice without water leaves nothing. A world without God, if one could imagine, would leave nothing. As does water fill ice, so does God fill the creation. The cold stiffens the water, causing a temporary formation. As God stiffens by his will, his spirit forming through his word a temporary form. This stiffening is actually forming a substantiality from the unmanifest, or something from nothing. A basic tenet of the Torah is that God creates the universe from nothing, that is, from no pre-existence substance. 13. Consider. Free will of man versus divine destiny. Free will of man proclaims man's ability to choose good or evil. As is stated, I place before you this day the life and the good and the death and the evil. the blessing and the curse. Therefore, choose life. Divine destiny implies that none escape God's will. Can any hide in secret places that I do not see him? Does man have freedom of choice, or does God limit man's freedom by knowing what he will choose? If God knows absolutely that someone is going to walk a certain path, is that person really free to choose? Is it not already predetermined? And if he is not free to choose, why must he pay for his actions? As it says, he who sows iniquity shall reap vanity, and they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. And I will also do this unto you. Does God control, or does God relinquish control to man? God does control, and God does relinquish control to man. This is not a contradiction, nor a hidden statement that requires intuitive understanding. God controls everything at all times. There is not a blade of grass nor a solar system that escapes his eternal lordship for even an instant. God is omnipresent and omnipotent. So what is left for man to choose? The answer lies in perspectives. Man is free to choose, but the free will seen to be man choosing is actually God, clothed as man choosing. The life of man within man as man is also God. Blessed be the life of all worlds. Man is limited. So by allowing man to exist, has God become limited? How can the unlimited be limited? By having created the appearance of limitations, God has not become limited. When we look through a tunnel, we do not limit ourselves, but merely focus our vision through the tunnel. We have not limited our ability to see, but have only limited what we are looking at. God, by looking through the limited eyes he has created and placed in man, has not limited himself, but is merely looking through a limited tool. In man, God focuses a portion of his eternal vision through the limited eye in order to produce the distinctions required for life to go on within the framework of creation. Does man then have free will? Yes. God, acting as man, chooses freely within the scope of man's created abilities. Does God know what man will choose? Yes. None escape the all. Do these contradict? No. Both aspects exist at once. When man is focused upon, man and his free will are seen to be choosing. When God is focused upon, the all-knowing is seen to be choosing. Does God, by having created the appearance of limitation, limit himself? No, he is still all. Even after creation and distinction appears, God is unchanged. Like a rainbow, all of the colors are within the white light. After the light is bent through a prism, the aspect of color becomes visible to the naked eye. A single aspect of the light, that is color, has become manifest. But the light has not become limited because one of its aspects became revealed. God, the All, does not become limited as his creation becomes evident. Creation is the actualization of the Creator's will. Unlike an earthly creator, such as a carpenter who makes a table from pre-existing matter and then leaves it, God creates something from nothing and thus must sustain it constantly. This he does by his vivifying will, which if, God forbid, was removed, would cause the creation to revert to nothing. 14. Consider. He is the knower and the knowledge and the known. Am I included in God's knowledge? Am I known by God? Am I the thing known? Then I am included in God, since the knowledge and the known and the knower are all one. Do I know? Am I the knower? Yes, I know that I am sitting here. Then who are you who also say, I know? And your brother, is he not an I? And the answer is, we are one. The I you are, the I am, are the same I am that speaks to Moses and says, I am the Lord your God. There is nothing else. 15. Consider, God does not change. You were the same before the world was created. You are the same since the world has been created. Since God does not change, and since the world around us seems to change, how can they be one? The same way the infant you were at birth and the adult you are now are the same person. You may appear in different clothing, but it is still you inside that body. The basic being that you were is the same being you are. Merely your experiences have changed, but you are still you, like white light that has the perspective of colors within it. When viewed either as white light or as colors, the light does not change. So it is with God, who has all of the possible perspectives within. When these perspectives are brought into creation, no change has occurred in God. Just the perspective has changed. 16. Consider. Since God is all, may I bow down to a flower? God forbid. Since God is all, may I bow down to God within the flower? God forbid. Since God is all, even me, must I bow down at all? Yes, a flower is a portion of creation, a portion of all. One must not worship a portion, as this must be at the expense of failing to worship the all. God will not tolerate a division in God, nor will God share glory with another. Those who try to divide God bring upon themselves and those around them a wrath like that of a jealous king who witnesses a subject placing a prince above or even beside him. He will say, I, and I alone, am king. Those who worship the God within the flower are worshiping a tiny portion of an aspect of God and are excluding all else. By omission, they are in fact creating in their minds an all else. This would be an other, and there is no other. Having created an other, they then pursue this figment of their imagination, which is in fact their own lust. The boundary that they have set up in their minds in the first place, the containment of God that they wish to worship, is in fact an expression of this lust. They then worship this containment, which is actually worshiping their personal lust. This must lead to a dead end. Then why bow down at all? Humility is a fence against arrogance. How awesome are the heavens, how much more so their creator. Those who are searching will want to find. Seeking in an unknown realm leaves man all but helpless. What tools can open which space? By lowering the head, greater heights can be seen. And if one is begging entrance, he would be wise to follow the customs of those within. Where should one direct worship? Toward the one which is everywhere, the only. 17. Consider. All belong to God. What then is meant by declaring Israel is my firstborn? Did not creation precede Israel? If Israel is God's firstborn, then to whom do all those who preceded Israel belong? When it is stated, Israel is my firstborn, the Torah is stating that Israel was chosen to be the first nation on earth to be monotheistic, the first nation to be made aware of the true existence of the one and only God. All is God, and all is God's. As it stated, all the earth is mine. The lowest to the highest have no other owner. It is all His. There is no other. 18. Consider. The pygmies in the darkest jungle have been told by their fathers when they need to take a tree from the forest, they should take the tallest tree first. The young pygmies never questioned the wisdom of this advice, but simply followed it, knowing their fathers understood more than they did about the forest. All went well for them until now. Now, the mineral wealth discovered within the traditional pygmy homeland is being stripped mined by the government, and instead of only the tallest trees being taken, all trees are being removed at once. The forest ecology has been destroyed, and the pygmies have been placed on the endangered species list. The American Indians, the Hopis, were given explicit warnings as to what may or may not be adopted from the white man's culture. By not following their father's advice, their portion has all but disappeared. From the Aboriginal in Australia to the Eskimo in Alaska, each has been given away according to their capabilities. No one has been left out, and have been wise leaders sent for the non-Jew and their laws for all mankind as well. All may know God. All may know peace. To assume differently is to assume there is a stingy or tyrannical designer. The Jew also has been given away, the Torah. Within it are many wonders, a treasure chest laid open, inviting the Jew to glean its benefits, long life, peace, a secure homeland, marrow to the bones, children, and on and on. Why, then, do so many Jews forsake these treasures for the tinsel of fame or wealth, or for the fickle taste of power? Why have so many been lost to the abortionist suction cup? Why have so many chosen a raging blemish instead of a peaceful life? O Israel, what nation on earth beside you has traded their gods? 19. Consider, the king knows what his son can do, but he tests him so the son will know what the son can do. This is why God asks Adam in the garden, "Where are you?" Does God not know where Adam is? Of course, but Adam had not considered where Adam was spiritually. To accomplish this test, God placed before man choice. Choose life and prosper. Choose death and die. If there were no choice, we would all be angels standing on one leg, without a right or wrong. There would be no need to have created the world of apparent duality where man walks upon two legs. 20. Consider, once upon a time there was a king, not just a normal earthly king, but a king who could do whatever he wished, spiritually as well as physically. He would shine in such glory that when a subject would come into his presence, the sweet feeling of bliss emanating from the king would so overwhelm the subject that he would actually yield his own existence and merge with the radiating light, leaving the king to sit alone in his chambers. This seemed fine to the king, since his subject loved it so. But when the king decided to have a feast, a great problem arose. "How," thought the king, "can I have a great feast alone? What joy can come from that? But whenever I invite my subjects into my court, they choose to nullify themselves and merge into the bliss, leaving me alone again. What can I do?" Then a wonderful idea came to the king. "I know what I will do. I can do whatever I wish. So I will disguise myself with masks and costume myself to appear as each of my subjects at once. Then, when I walk into my court, I will seem to be in a room filled with many different people. I will sing and dance and eat and drink away the time, always with a mask covering my true identity, until the end of the feast, when I will take off my disguise, and behold, it will be only me standing there. And so it is with this world. You and I are masked as individual subjects of the Holy King. But in the end, we will lift off our disguises, and behold, the Holy King will be seen to be all. As it is written, in that day the Lord will be one, and his name will be one." 21. Consider, in the early 1900s, modern medicine arrived at a most startling observation. By washing the surgeon's hands after performing a procedure, the next patient the surgeon treats will not die of the same disease that killed the first patient. To this simple act alone has been attributed the saving of more lives than any other treatment discovered by man. Since this discovery, not a single medical student has ever refused to wash his hands before or after treating a patient. But we, the Jewish nation, were told more than 3,000 years ago to wash after touching a dead body. We were told specifically how to wash, but not why to wash. Even though there is a definite health benefit in washing, health has never been singled out to be the reason that we wash. We wash simply because we're told to wash. The instructions should have been enough. Need a father explain to his son how the motor on the elevator works? Or is it enough to simply instruct him how to press the proper button? But we rebelled, and most of us stopped washing and instead followed the ways of those around us. What we did came back upon us. Our acting like the nations around us caused us to be dispersed among them. We traded our holy Torah for a wisp of this or a whiff of that, so much so that many of our children have even forgotten that they are Jews. 22. Consider. When a man comes home from the minyan on Friday night, as he opens the door, there are two angels on his sides, one on the right and one on the left. If the man finds his home in order, the wife and children awaiting the father's return, dressed in their Shabbos best, candles lighted, wine and challah ready, a delicious meal prepared, the angel on the right shoulder says, "Let it be this way next Friday night also." And the angel on the left must say, "Amen." If, however, when the man returns on Friday night and finds the house a mess and his children and wife disheveled, no light, no wine, no food prepared, the angel on the left says, "Let it be this way next Friday night also." And the angel on the right must say, "Amen." What you sow, you will reap. This portion leads to a like portion. Good brings good. Evil brings evil. As simple as this principle is, once revealed and understood, there is no better information available for the person who wants to do good and to avoid evil. Knowing that like deeds follow enables one to gain a great leverage in the battle against the seemingly innate inclination toward greed and lust. Whereas the entire mound of one's desires towards evil may seem insurmountable, by utilizing this knowledge, one can direct these inclinations to one's favor by merely doing a single good deed. One need not destroy the entire evil inclination at once, a task that would dishearten even the most righteous. But by doing a simple kind act, the reward will be the opportunity to do another kind act, which will again lead to a further opportunity. By saying no to the opportunity to do evil, it will be easier to say no again the next time an opportunity avails itself. Step by step, little by little, even a small spoon can move mountains. And in the end, you will know the Lord. 23. Consider. The mind of the depressive can be affixed onto joy. This is done not by working with the depression, but rather by working with joy. Depression and guilt have perfectly acceptable functions in creation. As it says, "To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven." How could an injured person know that his foot had been cut if there were no pain? The pain is not the problem. It is merely a signal that something needs tending. Likewise, guilt is not the problem, but merely a signal to the chief of the system that something needs to be altered. A person without a proper guilt response would be a cold-blooded terror to society. A person with an excessive and undue guilt reflex is a bore and burden to the world. Such a person is robbing the moment of its joy. Although the depressive does not understand it, his depression is chosen freely. Joy also can be chosen. In fact, joy can be chosen even more easily than sorrow. Therefore, choose life. Choose the blessing. 24. Consider. Time appears to be divided into three parts, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Are these three separate times, or is all time one? The captain on the ship's bridge has a panoramic view. When he looks at the horizon, he sees an island surrounded by water, a single scene. When the passenger below looks out from a porthole, first he sees water, then as the ship travels further, he sees land, and finally, as the ship travels on still further, he sees water again. These seem to be three separate scenes to him. What from below seems to be three, from above is seen to be one. 25. Consider. The human soul must travel through its allotment, acquiring and discarding. It must acquire what it came into form for, as that particular person, and it must lose what it came to give up until it can stand naked, free from the desires that caused the initial agitation that brought it into being. For example, a soul before taking a body discerns if by taking that particular body it will have the opportunity to satisfy its desires to do a certain mitzvah. And also, will it be able to rid itself of any undesirable dross remaining from its previous lives? For instance, by gaining fame, the desire to be famous falls away, so that soul is relieved of that burden, until such time as all of God's commandments have been accomplished by that soul, and it is also free from all of its desires, it will be forced to return to life clothed in a physical body. Once this is achieved, the soul will only come as all life returns and gathers to dance around the Messiah, and man will learn war no more. 26. Consider. There is enough food in the world to feed everyone, yet people are starving. There's also a second type of needless starvation, which can happen even to the wealthy. This comes from eating too much valueless food. Although the people eat great quantities, they remain undernourished. They are left unsatisfied and eventually lose their health. There's a third type of needless starvation, which is similar to this. This is spiritual starvation. Just as a physical body must be nourished, so must the soul be nourished. And just as huge amounts of valueless food will not bring physical health, neither will huge amounts of valueless spiritual practices bring spiritual health. Quantity cannot satisfy quality. No matter how much valueless food is poured into the soul, it will remain hungry and untouched. Even the souls of the dead long for satisfaction. How much more so the living. The living dead. The living who do not know life. The living who count the days as dollars to be accumulated and consider wealth to be measured by the pound are vacant lots overgrown with weeds. Their wealth will end up in the hands of strangers. They heap up riches and do not know who will gather them. Their souls will languish thirsty and unsatisfied. Yet from even this deep sleep one can awaken. There is time if one will only begin. Once you start, and as long as you persist, it will be accounted to you as if you had completed the entire journey. 27. Consider. What you keep, you will lose, and what you give away, you will keep. A person who dies without having given proper charity will have lost in this world and in the world to come. While the charity one gives away will be accounted to that soul forever, his physical possessions will be distributed upon his death. These are gone from him forever, divided among people he may not even have seen. But his charity account precedes his soul eternally. 28. Consider. Right first when going forward towards something precious. Left first when backing away from something precious. Put on the right first and take off the left first. These are simple steps that can be taken to gain in the spiritual realm by utilizing the physical. Right first towards goodness, The right side is depicted as the stronger, and we should move toward good things in life with strength. Backing away from the desirable should be done hesitantly. Therefore, the left backs away first. Put on the right first. Reach for what is right first. Discard the left, the weaker, first. By following these instructions, when we dress and undress, as we walk throughout the day, we are training ourselves to make correct moral and spiritual decisions. Not only will we be better off in this world, but we will have trained ourselves to receive a greater portion in the world to come. 29. Consider. With a life that is all spiritual, one could inadvertently walk off a cliff. With a life that is all physical, one might just as well walk off a cliff. The spiritual purpose of life must be worked out in the physical place of creation. It is exactly for this reason that the soul has appeared to become physical. We do not escape from the physical into the spiritual, but rather we are to elevate the physical until we are able to see the spiritual in it. A completely physical life is futile, for it will soon turn to dust. What is physically accumulated? The physical life ends when the body falls away, and only the mitzvot and transgressions remain. All people are given a way to elevate the physical around them. For the Jew, there are 613 commandments given to Moses well over 3,000 years ago. For the Gentile, there are traditions in many languages that reveal God's path and presence on earth. Any ethical monotheistic religion would teach this very truth, namely, God's omnipresence. This is, in fact, the primary spiritual reason, the great truth that all spiritual seekers seek. To uncover this presence, to realize the knowledge of God, is the reason so many endure even extreme hardships while searching. Some are born into knowing families. Their search is calm. Some are born inquisitive. Their search is intense. Many are born into empty times and never know that they are even searching. What is there to seek? How has it been sought? Some sit in meditative trances, distant caves in the Himalayas, silent stares, physical postures, derelict deprivations, fasting or chanting, wandering, heads shaved or hair grown wild, seeking under this stone and another, confessing, professing, here, there, where, asking who am I, or just plain am I, crying, begging, flying, the soul on fire seeking a stay in the glimmer it once saw, trying to pry open the shut door that is not even there, and finally, when all else fails, returning to the place their soul first chose to be, themselves. For the Jew, this place is to be the Jew, using the tool created for the Jew, the Torah. For the pygmy, this means to be a pygmy and to follow the wisdom of the righteous ancestral teachings handed down from Noah. The Hopi Indian will find in his righteous Hopi tradition. And so it will be with all of the righteous. Each will find their peace in what their soul was created to be, and in there there'll be liberation. 30. Consider. The physical is the spiritual. The physical world can be seen as purely matter, that is, substantial or concrete. On a more enlightened plane, we realize that matter is really presented in creation as a form of energy. Matter and energy are a relationship, just as physical and spiritual are a relationship. These terms denote perspectives. Material denotes concrete or substantial, while energy denotes flowing or power. Physical denotes worldliness or something perceptible through the senses, while spiritual denotes breath, wind, or transcendental. There are perspectives within the spectrum of creation. The identical spot may be pointed to and said to be either energy or matter, spiritual or physical. by understanding that the place where the matter appears is also the exact place where the energy is appearing, it can be seen that the physical is an aspect or perspective of the spiritual. Matter, energy, physical, and spiritual are terms that measure, identify, or evaluate perspectives of the same place. Look carefully at the physical, and you will be able to see it is also the spiritual. Concentrating on an empty glass will lead to this realization. First, the surface of the glass will be seen, then the airspace within the glass, then finally one will see through the glass onto the space beyond the glass. Now, with all this visible, begin to concentrate on the inside thickness of the glass itself. Here, while looking at one point at one time, we see the surface of the glass, its airspace, the space beyond the glass, and now the inside thickness of the glass itself. Now imagine the glass to be momentarily disappeared, leaving just the space it occupied. Bring the glass back, and we see that its space is still there unaffected. We can see both the space inside the thickness of the glass and the thickness of the glass at once. This dissolving of the glass into space and then back into glass somewhat parallels a shift in spiritual to physical perspectives. Just as we know that matter is energy manifesting as matter, so can we know that the physical is the spiritual manifesting as the physical. When you grab the portion, you grab the all. 31. Consider, not even a sadhi can stand in the place of the repentant. A king had two sons, both quite dear to him. One son, while still very young, slipped away from his guard and disappeared into the crowd. Days went by and then years, and the young prince forgot his father and his lofty inheritance. In fact, he wandered as the simplest of peasants, lost and struggling to make even the slightest way. Then, through some miracle that seemed like chance, the son saw his father passing through a village. The father's regal entourage, the fine horses and carriages, the very glory of the earthly king snapped the stray prince back, and he recalled his true identity. By having seen the splendor, his blindness had been pierced. He ran up to the king and fell upon his face weeping. The good king bent down and immediately recognized his son. He drew the ragged prince into his arms and kissed him. At that moment, his other son was sitting beside him. This son had never strayed. He was close to his father and had learned everything intended for a prince. But at that moment, his tear-stained, ragged brother was sitting closer, not merely next to the glorious king, but with his head actually upon the king's lap. And so it is with you and I. Many of us slipped away from our true father's ways and have forgotten our real heritage, and have taken on the strange ways of distant peoples. Instantly we can be given a glimpse of glory, and instantly we can shed the layers of filth and return to our rightful place. Not only are we welcomed more than our brothers who never strayed, but the further we have strayed, the greater is our welcome. The depths we trudged, the valleys we gorged, turn over and become mountains to stand upon. 32. Consider, a car is speeding down the highway, 50, 60, even 70 miles per hour. Unnoticed by the driver, it begins to slide over the center line, approaching a head-on collision with the oncoming traffic. Certain death awaits. A horrible instant seems to be unavoidably approaching. The driver finally sees a mistake, but the speed is so great it is impossible to stop. His knuckles whiten on the steering wheel, and he screams for help. What seems to be an inevitable death can easily be avoided by simply turning the steering wheel back toward the correct side of the highway. The vehicle will follow. The oncoming cars will whiz by safely, and the driver will breathe the easy and thankful breath of a saved person. So it is with us. As we speed through life, we do not notice that we have slipped over onto the other side. There are no horrible immediate consequences that we are aware of. We simply continue to speed along our way. Then when we finally see the oncoming traffic, it seems too late. Our habits feel entrenched and our speed too great. Life seems too short to allow a safe return, so we give up and slide away. But look, as easily as the entire car turns with the slightest touch of the wheel, so will your life follow the least little turn of your will. The small wheel begins the turn and the huge speeding automobile must follow. And so it is with the wheel we turn in our heart. The slightest turn of our desires to do good, the least pang of remorse that we have slipped onto the wrong side, can instantly send the entire person back onto the safe side of the highway. The desire to do good, to be on the safe side, will automatically create the opportunity to do good, which will again create a further opportunity to do good, and we will securely be on our way. Once we have been saved from certain death, we'll be more careful how we steer our lives. 33. Consider, why is the Jew so precious to creation? Of course, all of creation is dear, but the Jew has a unique place in the heart of the Creator. Jews make up approximately 1/3 of 1% of the world's population. Yet Jews have constructively contributed to civilization far in excess of this percentage. Virtually no field of endeavor lacks at least one or two Jewish champions. But all people endeavor, not just the Jew. All desire to improve their lot, and many make well-needed contributions to society. Each has a special task assigned. Again, the Jew is no different in this. Some people have chosen to be builders, some have chosen to be destroyers. Some have a role to come into being in a dense jungle, thriving for a moment, and then becoming extinct, leaving not even a trace of their having come or having gone, like water closing up after a finger is taken out. But even these are beloved to the Creator. To each a task, to each a way, to each a blessing. For the Jew, the role is to be a nation of priests, a blessing to the nations. The Jew begins to fulfill this appointed task as he or she assumes the priestly duties. Today, due to our transgressions, the Holy Temple in Yerushalayim is no longer standing. So the priestly duties connected to the actual temple service are now in abeyance as we wait for the arrival of the Messiah and the third and final temple. For now, there remains the temple of the heart, and our prayers have become the sacrifices. Thoughts are subtle things, but this does not diminish their effect on the world. In fact, due to their subtleness, they can travel where more gross physical things cannot. By praying for someone's speedy recovery, the required payback period for their illness is shortened. This is the duty of the Jew, to praise God by learning Torah and by carrying out its precepts, to pray for and to bless all of the people in creation, for the women to light Shabbos candles, maintain family purity, and supervise the family's diet, for the man to don tallis tefillin, for all to pray for the welfare of the world, to stand and sing out to God, asking forgiveness for the Jew and non-Jews also, to bless the legal government, to pray for the sick, for rain and dew, for the hastening of the resurrection of the dead, and for knowledge, repentance, pardon, and redemption, for mercy and favor, for all the living, blessed be the life of all the worlds. Prayers not only seep into the atmosphere and slowly work their wonders, but also affect the person praying. Can someone beg for forgiveness so many times without becoming more forgiving himself? Since the destruction of our holy temple, may it be restored in our day, stress is placed on the other types of altars. The service of the heart must now carry an increased share of the burden. Although service of the heart has always been intended to be an integral aspect of Judaism, the sacrifice of repentance and prayer must now fill in with additional concentration and sincerity to replace the service of the Kohen in Yerushalayim. Since the temple service was manifested primarily to affect the heart, now that the physical reminder, the immense joy and the awesome glory of the temple, has been temporarily removed, it is even more incumbent upon us to fulfill the requirements of the individual heart. The dining table is also an essential Jewish altar, and it is the Jew's duty to see to it that all of the prescribed order is observed. First of all, the food offered must be kosher. The proper order of service must be followed. First the wine, then the bread. The hands must be washed correctly. And perhaps most important, the exact words of blessings and thanks must be recited. Only when these and the many intricacies are adhered to will the table begin to be a proper altar. Only then does the Jewish family begin to come into its prescribed and privileged domain. The Jew has been blessed because of the Jewish fathers who have gone before, because I love them, and a blessing has been to know God, to receive the Torah, and to inherit the land of Israel. There is one.com.